Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, brought to you every Saturday on Premier Christian Radio, but broadcasting around the world via our podcast. And I'm very excited to say that today's show is a special one, partly because of the guests I've got on, one of whom will be at this year's Unbelievable Conference 2019. Yes, it's happening Saturday, the 20th of July at Westminster Central Hall, London, and the ticketing is now officially open. So all of those who've been getting in touch saying, when will you be releasing details? How can I book my ticket? It is possible to do that right now at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievableconference. Or you can find it from the Unbelievable webpage as well. But it's going to be a great day on Saturday, the 20th of July. We're inviting you to join the revolution and speak truth in a post-truth world. That's our conference title this year, in partnership this time with Biola Apologetics and ADF International. I think we're actually seeing a new generation of confident Christians being raised up. Unbelievable is part of that story, but this is going to be a day specifically to equip you to share the truth of Christianity in a world full of fake news. There's going to be seminars on creating better conversations, responding to atheism, Islam, other worldviews, and generally being a confident Christian in a world that often wants to shut down dialogue. Sound fun? Well, check out the speakers we've got confirmed so far. They include Professor J.P. Moreland, who we're hearing from on today's show, and Craig Hazen, both from Biola, and more speakers to be confirmed. Paul Coleman and Andy Tonhauser of ADF International. They'll be leading seminars on some hot-button issues like gay cakes, abortion, and religious freedom. Sarah Lumger on Islam and youth apologetics. Really looking forward to having Sarah back at the conference. She's been with us before under her pre-married name, Sarah Foster. Krish Kandaya joins us, evangelist and author on creating better conversations with those you disagree with. Such a great communicator, Krish. And from the other side of the pond as well, another great communicator, Bruxy Cavey. I'm just a huge fan of Bruxy's. He's pastor of the Meeting House in Toronto, Canada. And he's going to be talking about how to make the good news of Jesus relevant to sinners, saints, and skeptics. Ruth Jackson and Emily Howarth of Premier Youth and Children's Work will be with us to lead the youth stream. And we've more speakers to be announced. It's very exciting. Unbelievable, the conference 2019, Saturday, the 20th of July. Do check out the lineup so far, the theme, and how to book for the cheap early bird ticket price as well. There's also student and group discounts available at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievableconference. Book in now and join the revolution. Let's get into today's show.
You're unbelievable.
Today on the show, we're asking, is scientism the new religion? Christian philosopher J.P. Moreland and atheist philosopher Stephen Law join me on today's show. J.P. Moreland is a distinguished professor of philosophy at Biola University in California. He's the author of many books, and his latest, Scientism and Secularism, Learning to Respond to a Dangerous Ideology, is out now. As I've already said, JP will be part of an awesome lineup of speakers at this year's Unbelievable Conference 2019 in central London on Saturday, the 20th of July. Stephen Law is a humanist philosopher who edits the philosophical journal Think. He's also the author of various books, including The War for Children's Minds and Believing BS. You know what that stands for. How not to get sucked into an intellectual black hole. This is the family-friendly version, you understand, Stephen, of the show. Back in 2011, he famously debated a well-known colleague of JP's, William Lane Craig, in a live London debate for Unbelievable. But that seems a long time ago now, Stephen, would you say?
Yes. Well, yeah. It is quite a long time.
It was. Yeah. 7 years ago or more.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm looking forward to today's show as we debate the limits of science as a route to knowledge, and whether naturalism or theism provides a better explanatory framework for the things that science can't tell us. Now, you may be thinking, isn't this a bit like that conversation between John Lennox and Peter Atkins you had on a few weeks ago, Justin? Well, admittedly, the topics do overlap, but I think we'll be covering quite a lot of different ground this time round, so I'm looking forward to today's show. JP and Stephen, welcome along to the programme today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. JP, let's start with you as a newcomer to the show. First time on the show. Can't believe we haven't had you on before, really. Very much looking forward to having you over in the UK as well in July for the Unbelievable Conference. Do you get to come to the UK much, or will this be the first time in a while?
It'll be the first time in a while. I've been there two or three times, but I don't come over very often.
Well, I'm glad that we've given you a good excuse to visit our fair city of London and to talk about what you do and obviously present some of these seminars and talks at this year's Unbelievable Conference. I'm sure this book that we're going to be looking at today will feature as part of that.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely. Let's talk about this book, because you begin the book actually by talking about how you almost went into a career in science initially, though you ended up obviously in philosophy. Tell us about how that happened, JP.
Well, I was an undergraduate physical chemistry major, and I was accepted to do a PhD in nuclear chemistry at a major university here in the United States. But my junior year in college, I was converted to be a Jesus follower, and chemistry would have been a wonderful career, but I started getting interested in philosophical questions, and I, at that point, thought philosophy was psychology misspelled. I had absolutely no idea what it was, but I grew an interest in it, and then eventually got my MM PhD.
So you've always been fascinated by science. And your book,
yes,
in many ways, is a call to do science better, because you believe actually it's, in many ways today, overstepped the boundaries of what it's supposed to do for us.
Well, yes. And I think that the culture in Western culture, certainly American culture, has accepted, without knowing the name of it, an epistemology of scientism. And thus, science has an authority that it ought not have, and it has authority in areas where, quite frankly, science is just unable to speak to. So my book is an attempt to kind of defend more of a pluralistic view of knowing, that there are ways of knowing, and that there are limits to science, and scientism is not a rational position to hold.
We'll get to defining science in a moment's time, scientism, I should say, but is it your feeling that, I don't know, that is it the last 50 years or so that this particular kind of scientism has really taken hold, in your view?
I think it would be a little bit longer than that. I think in America, there's a book called The Origin of the Making of the Modern University that traces the development of scientism from 1880 up till about the Scopes trial in the mid-1920s. So from that time, it began to develop, but I don't think we saw it flowering until the 30s, 40s, 50s. And then Kuhn's book comes out and all chaos breaks loose. And it's an odd history, but I do think it's been gaining steam in the last few decades, as you pointed out.
We'll come back to you in a moment's time for more on scientism. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
I think I said before we came on air that it's been something like 2.5 years, I think, since you were last on. So
yeah,
time flies.
It does.
I think you've often been on to debate issues like how can we know that what we know is reliable and that sort of thing. Epistemology, as it's sometimes called, to give it its technical title. You've even been on with people like Alvin Plantinga in the past to debate that.
Yeah.
But you, just because we've had a little bit of an intro to JP, I think you had a kind of unusual way into philosophy as well yourself, didn't you? You didn't sort of start on the academic route exactly.
That's true, actually, yeah. So I had a couple of goes at doing A-levels, which is what you do in this country before you go to university. I had a couple of shots at that. The first time I was asked to leave.
The second time, can you tell us why?
Well, I was just a good-for-nothing hippie, basically. Okay. And the second time I left because I've just found it so dull.
Right.
And I ended up being doing various jobs, but one of which was I was a postman for Cambridge for about 4 years. I used to do a lot of reading, thinking, and eventually I realised that there was this subject, philosophy, that actually, you know, you could study, and it was the focus of many of, you know, many of the questions that I was particularly interested in and spent a lot of time thinking about and reading about. And once I discovered that, I thought, well, actually, I would really like to go to university and study this, despite not having the usual formal qualifications to do so. And by some miracle, I actually managed to talk my way into university to study at the City University in London to begin with. And from there, and I did well. From there, I went to Oxford, did the BPhil, did the doctorate. I was a research fellow there, and then I moved to Heythrop College.
So it goes to show that sometimes you just need to find the right thing that sparks the imagination, and then the rest follows.
Yeah.
But you're an atheist, and that, in a sense, has that always been the case? Has your philosophy always appeared to support that worldview?
I think I started off in my 20s, as I mentioned, as a bit of a hippie and with an interest in the transcendent. And I became more sceptical as I did more philosophy about that kind of thing. I might still like to think that I was, you know, open-minded, but the fact is that, no, I'm not persuaded that there's any kind of transcendent realm. I don't believe in any gods
Do you wear a label like naturalist?
No, I don't like those labels at all. I am an atheist. I would describe myself as a humanist. I'm not sure what naturalism even means. People often assume that all, you know, philosophers and scientists nowadays, they're all naturalists. Actually, there was a poll done of professional philosophers and graduate students a few years ago, the Phil Papers survey, which revealed that only about half of professional philosophers and graduate students even lean towards naturalism.
Okay, but, so if say naturalism was defined as something like all that ultimately exists are the natural forces, matter, energy, motion, so on, that's it all boils down to that.
Yeah, that may be true. I might lean a little bit in that direction, but I'm not wedded to that.
Right.
And my atheism certainly doesn't depend on that. No.
Okay, interesting. Let's talk about scientism, JP.
Yes.
Scientism, as you said, you're not anti-science, but you are anti-scientism. So give us the definition of scientism, and you also talk about weak and strong scientism in your book.
Yes. Scientism comes in two major forms. One of them is strong scientism, which says that the only way to know truth about reality and have rationally justified beliefs about reality is through the methods of the hard sciences. And so if you can test it and verify it in physics, chemistry, and some of the hard sciences, then you can know it. But if it's not so amenable, then it is something that you can't know. It may not even be true, but if it is true, no one knows. Weak scientism will allow for some level of warrant or justification in certain fields outside the hard sciences, but compared to the hard sciences, they provide a vastly superior form of knowledge than do other fields. And so, for example, if psychology begins to return to the idea of a self, a substantial ego that has a libertarian agency, which is a move that's happened in psychology in the last 20 years. If neuroscience says that's just not true, and we can explain everything about human functioning with the brain, then neuroscience is going to trump psychology because it is more wedded to the hard sciences than psychology is. So those are the those are the two major forms of scientism. And I think that neither one of them is true or rational. And that's kind of the thesis of my book. You see, you can see what that, if one of these were true, what that would mean would be that claims in metaphysics or ethics or political assertions or theological claims and so on would be claims that would either not be true, or if they were true, nobody would know or have any kind of justified belief about them. And so they would all be relegated to kind of a sort of a postmodern relativist constructivism.
And in your view, I assume scientism very often goes hand in hand with naturalism. People who are believe in a sense in scientism are very often naturalists who believe that all that ultimately exists is matter in motion and the physical laws of the universe and so on.
Yes, I think Stephen's right that there's a cottage industry of versions of naturalism. So it is hard to come up with one single definition of it. That, and as Stephen pointed out, that said, I do think there's a major version of it that says it starts with an epistemology, and this epistemology has a handful of elements to it, but one of them is a commitment to scientism in one form or the other. And then it has a creation account of how everything that is came to be. It's in general terms, rooted in the atomic theory of matter and evolutionary biology. And then there is an ontology that drops out of that, according to which the physical universe is all there is. Everything within the physical universe is purely physical. And if there are emergent properties, then they must be determined by and fixed by or supervenient on the physical. So I think that would, so the bottom line then is scientism would be a component of a naturalist epistemology.
I've titled this show, Is Scientism the New Religion? Slightly tongue-in-cheek, obviously, Stephen, but I do sometimes feel actually some atheists, science is almost regarded with a religious kind of fervor. You know, it's the secret to life, the savior of humanity, the way, the truth, and the life, or whatever. I mean, what's your view? Do you think that people do get too ensconced in what science can do for us? Do you think that scientism, as JP defines it, does exist quite widely in society?
Well, as a philosopher, you would expect me to reject scientism. And, you know, I do. It seems to me that there are questions that science necessarily cannot answer, is not properly equipped to answer, and that actually armchair reflection in some cases can answer.
Can give you knowledge, in a sense.
Yeah, so, and if you like, we could talk about some examples of that, but that's my view. Mm-hmm. So I don't sign up to scientism. I'm aware that there are many different definitions of scientism. So some people will define it as the view that, you know, hard sciences provide our only knowledge or our only knowledge of reality, for example, as JP's just suggested. But then you also find people suggesting that scientism is the view that science alone can answer any legitimate question, or if the question can be answered at all, science will be the right way to answer it. So there are many different ways of characterizing it. I personally reject it. I've only ever met one person in my whole life who signs up to the view that science can answer every question. And that was that? Professor Peter Atkins.
Ah, funny you should mention that, because I had a show with him a few weeks ago, yeah. and he very categorically stated that.
That's yeah, yeah, he is really quite exceptional. He's the only person I've ever met that has taken that view. Are you saying that
someone else we know well, Richard Dawkins, wouldn't go as far as that Peter Atkins in
No, well, Dawkins in doesn't go as far as Atkins. Right. I mean, I know that for a fact. So, yeah. So, in fact, when I'd explained what I thought philosophy was to Richard Dawkins, as armchair reflection, as conceptual work, and that, you know, considerable progress can be made in that way, he said, "Oh, yeah, absolutely." He just wants to call it science. So it turns out that Richard Dawkins has a rather elastic conception of science that would actually include, you know, all of rational thought, whatever we can establish by means of reason.
I mean, you do
not
get,
just the scientific method.
So what do you think of when people like Stephen Hawking, for instance, started their book, The Grand Design, saying philosophy is dead? Has he just basically misunderstood what philosophy is, because in the very next paragraphs he's doing some philosophy by defining science and the universe?
That's a very interesting quote, and you have to tease out two different things here. So one of them is empiricism, which is the view that if you want to know about reality, the world outside your own mind, then you're going to have to use your five senses. You're going to have to observe reality. That is our only window onto reality. That's one view. That's certainly Peter Atkins' view. And that view leads Atkins to say, well, that philosophy is a complete waste of time then, because, you know, sitting in your armchair...
Which he said on my show a few weeks ago.
Of course he's going to say that, because of course, if you're an empiricist, you will think that sitting in your armchair, having a good old think with your eyes closed, right, that's not going to reveal how reality is out there, outside of your own mind. So I have some sympathy with empiricism. I kind of lean in that direction a bit, I have to say. However, I also think that you can establish pretty significant things from the comfort of your armchair, only they're not going to be things about external reality, but they are significant things. So I'll give you an example.
Yeah, go ahead.
So Galileo famously liked a thought experiment, you know, liked to sit in his armchair and have a good old think. And one of the experiments that he did was to test Aristotle's theory about how objects would fall when released. If you drop a larger, heavier ball than a lighter ball at the same time from the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, Aristotle's theories predicted that the two objects would land at different times, that the larger, heavier object would fall faster. And Galileo, in his armchair, conjured up the following scenario. Suppose we chain the two balls together. We've now combined them to produce an even heavier object. So the two balls combined should fall even faster than either of the balls did on its own, right? But in chaining the smaller ball to the heavier ball, you've now chained the ball that fell less quickly to the heavier ball, and so the heavier ball should now fall a bit slower than it did before. The little ball should go behind and act as a brake. So by helping ourselves to a few fairly innocuous assumptions, we can derive from Aristotle's theory a logical contradiction. The two balls combined fall faster and slower than they do individually. And a logical contradiction cannot be true, so Aristotle's theory is false. That was a work of genius, that little thought experiment, and it works. It does establish that a certain description of reality, namely Aristotle's, cannot be true because it contains a logical contradiction. However, and this is the punchline, right? However, that's not to say that we yet know what is going to happen to the two balls when you drop them off the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. You don't till you go and have a look.
Yeah, sure. Right?
So that's philosophical or conceptual work, armchair work. We've made great leaps forward there, right? And we've certainly discovered how reality isn't, because a certain description of it involves a contradiction. But that's not to say that we yet know how reality is. And it seems to me that actually to think of philosophy as a sort of grand metaphysical project of revealing how reality truly is, I think that probably is a grand waste of time.
That's not
to say that philosophy is a grand waste of time. I mean, we've just refuted Aristotle's theory, haven't we, from the comfort of our armchairs.
Okay.
Yeah, I hold a different view. I hold that metaphysics, for example, is a way of knowing reality. And I think that the sort of thing that Stephen is talking about is that philosophy is involved in conceptual analysis. And it does a great job at bringing order and analyzing and clarifying our concepts about reality. But then what we need to do is to go and test those against reality, unless we're able to generate a contradiction. Now, that I don't know if that's Stephen's view, but that certainly has been a major view in philosophy since what's called the linguistic turn, where this traces all the way back to Descartes with what was called his idea theory, But I don't know if that's the general framework Stephen's working in. But and you can comment to that, Stephen. But I mm-hmm. think that we have direct access to reality, and I think a priori knowledge is of mathematics and logic and metaphysics is actually a power of intuition and awareness into the realm of abstract objects and their relations.
Yeah. So this is where this is the classic debate about empiricism then. Okay. So if you're an empiricist, you think that your five senses provide you with your only window onto reality. And so by sitting in your armchair with your eyes closed and your fingers in your ears, you're not going to find out anything about reality. Whereas the rationalists think that, you know, there's at least one thing that you can know, a substantive thing about the world out there outside of your own mind that you can know purely by means of reflection. Possibly that's true. The problem that you then run into is that you need to give an account of how we could arrive at that knowledge. By what mechanism is this knowledge of external reality delivered to us, if not via the usual window of the five senses? And the word intuition immediately crops up at that point. So if you're a mathematical realist and you think that maths is out there in some kind of platonic mathematical reality, then how do you find out about that reality? Mathematical intuition. If you believe that there are moral facts out there in some kind of moral reality, how do you find out about that reality? Moral intuition. If there are modal facts about necessity and so on out there, logical facts, how do you find out about them? Some kind of logical intuition. Okay.
So you're wary of the word intuition, basically.
So yeah, so it's a word that stands in for, you know, it's a question mark. I mean, how the hell does that work? We have no idea, which is one of the main reasons why people tend to drift towards empiricism.
What's your response to that, JP?
Well, I think it's just false that before you can know something, you have to be able to tell how you know it or provide a mechanism for that. In fact,
no,
that
I didn't
is,
say that, though.
that's just not true. You can know things without knowing how you know them, and then you can build up criteria for knowledge subsequently.
This is a view
in epistemology known as particularism. I think that the idea that you have to know some mechanism is completely question begging, because I think there may be, I don't even know that there's a mechanism that is involved in sense experience. I highly doubt it. But the word intuition is not just a placeholder for I know not what. Edmund Husserl, in the Logical Investigations, did a very precise unpacking of what he called eidetic intuition. And there were some examples that he gave where you could know when you were experiencing an awareness of an abstract object. And so what I would say is that we have all kinds of knowledge by acquaintance, that is the power to be directly aware of things that are not sense perceptible. For example, I'm able to be aware of my own states of consciousness. I'm able to be aware of which sense organs are mine. I don't do that by empirical techniques. And I think that some of the foundational laws of metaphysics and of logic and mathematics, modal logic, and certain moral facts are themselves known by a power of being able to be aware of value or of mathematical entities and so on. Now,
let's just go to a quick break here, because we're just butting up against our first break, and I want to come back to you, JP, because I do want to explore this more, this idea that there are certain things, logic, maths, a priori aspects of reality, which science needs to assume in order for us to do science, and therefore science cannot explain everything, because there are these foundations, as it were, that are needed before you even get to do science. So I want to unpack that and then see what Stephen has to say in response. Fascinating show today, philosophical one, asking, is scientism the new religion? Based off the latest book by one of our guests, J.P. Moreland, Scientism and Secularism, Learning to Respond to a Dangerous Ideology. J.P. is a Christian. Stephen Law is our humanist philosopher, who's in conversation with him today, and we'll be back in a short moment's time.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme, asking, is scientism the new religion on Unbelievable today? Joined by Christian philosopher J.P. Moreland and atheist philosopher Stephen Law. And talking about J.P.'s new book, Scientism and Secularism. And by the way, again, J.P. will be with us for Unbelievable, the conference, Saturday the 20th of July. Book your ticket now for Central London. We were kind of talking about scientism. We defined that and talked a little bit about that in the first part of the show, J.P., and one of the, I think, the fascinating things in the book is the fact that you kind of talk about various aspects of reality which are themselves assumed in order to do science, and therefore it's difficult to see how you could say that science itself is explains these particular phenomena. And so, for instance, some of them include the phenomenon of logic and maths and some of those other things that you've been referring to there in that last section. Do you want to just unpack that a little bit and explain why these things need to be assumed and have a different, or in a kind of different category to the kind of things that science can explain for us and unpack for us?
Yes, I would say that they are assumptions relative to science, but not relative to philosophy, because I think philosophy is the field that clarifies these claims and provides justification for them or criticisms of them. For example, that there is such a thing as truth, and what exactly is its nature? Is it a correspondence with reality? The knowledge of normativity. For example, what is a good explanation and what is a bad one? What kind of epistemic virtues do good theories exemplify? Things like the laws of logic and mathematics. I would say certain moral knowledge, report your test results honestly and be fair with the data, and things of that sort. The value of epistemic simplicity. These are things that are, strictly philosophical, but yet they're all, I think, presuppositions relative to science, especially if we're going to take science in some kind of a realist sort of way. So that's a claim that I make, and then I make a claim that there are things outside of science that we know with as much or greater certainty than some of the things that we know in the hard sciences.
And so when it comes to things like the kind of laws of logic, which need to be there in place, as it were, before you can then go and, test things and make hypotheses and see if things are true, if those are not, as it were, there, if those have to be in place before you can do science, does that for you fall into the realm of being something we explore through philosophy then? And I suppose to take it a step further, does that in any way then give us grounds for saying, well, here's something which leads us into the realm of the supernatural, something that can't be explained in purely naturalistic terms? Because I know there is a whole realm of theology and apologetics which does see that these sort of so-called, transcendent things have some kind of, transcendent source in God.
Well, I've not made that claim yet, but I do believe that these kinds of issues fall properly within the purview of philosophical methodology, and logic is one of those. And when you do a proof in logic, you rely on intuition. And it's very interesting. I think Polanyi called this tacit knowledge, but skilled practitioners are able to hold more lines of a proof together in their intellectual gaze, as I would put it, and they're able to see, and that's not empirical, they're able to see that the one line actually follows from a line several lines up, whereas a novice is going to be able to have that kind of intuitive experience between maybe two lines. But it's the sort of thing where you can develop your mental ability to, quote, perceive intuitively the laws of logic themselves and how they relate propositions. And so, yes, I would take now that our faculties are able to do that. I don't think there is a good atheistic explanation for that, but I think there is a very good theistic explanation for it.
Okay, well, maybe we'll come to that in due course. But comment on what JP said so far there, Stephen, in terms of his view that there are these assumptions that we need to get going before we can test things empirically and scientifically and that kind of thing. These intuitions, he says, and it's not, you know, he has no problem with the idea of intuition. We do know things in a direct fashion, even if we can't give a mechanistic explanation for them.
Sure. Well, without looking at the specific examples that JP's just outlined, we're on the same page, obviously, okay, about scientism. We're of the view that science can't answer every legitimate question. And what this book does is it suggests that scientism is kind of all-pervasive. It constitutes the intellectual and cultural air we breathe, I think it says on page 26. And I'm not so sure about that. As I say, Peter Atkins is the only person I've ever met that actually was prepared to say that actually science can answer every legitimate question. That's the only person I've ever come across that takes that view. Here's an analogy, which may help illuminate what I think is going on. Not so many years ago, it was very common, particularly in the United States of America, if you were to express a sort of vaguely left-leaning view, perhaps that taxes should increase or something like that, you would almost certainly and immediately be accused in a kind of a knee-jerk way of being a communist, right? Any, you know, vaguely left-wing view was immediately seen to be communist, and it would be dismissed as a communist view. And everyone knows that communism is just dangerous nonsense, and so we can just put that out of our minds straight away. It was a very, very convenient way of shutting down debates and stuffing socks into the mouths of people that might be asking awkward questions or making difficult points. And it seems to me that something similar is now going on with the word scientism. Very few people actually do sign up to scientism. It is not the pervasive thing that it's often presented as being. And it seems to me that very often people read into comments that people make. They read into it scientism. Whereas if you actually look more carefully at what people are saying, it's not actually scientism after all. So looking at the book that JP has written, which is a very interesting book, he starts out by providing three examples of scientism to illustrate just how all-encompassing and pervasive it really is. And I looked at all three examples and I thought, this isn't scientism.
Give us the examples that you and then we'll have JP respond.
Sure. Yeah, so the last of the three was a quote from a State of California documents concerning public schools, which said that when scientific conclusions contradict a pupil's religious belief, you know, perhaps the scientific conclusion is that the universe is older than 6,000 years, say, or whatever it might happen to be, pupils should be told that while they may have reservations, that nevertheless that is the scientific consensus. Is that scientism, do you think, Justin?
Well, JP, what do you say? Is that what you intended to say there?
The quote goes much further. than Stephen has read, which is fine. But it goes on to say that the claims of science in that quote, which sets policy for the state of California public schools, describes the claims of science in deeply cognitive terms. They're facts about which no one in science disputes. They are part of our intellectual heritage. They're,
sorry, is this in the quotation on page 28 of your book? Because I'm looking at it.
I don't have the
book. Let me quote what you did quote from this particular guidance that was issued. It says here, the document offered teachers advice about how to address students who expressed reservations about the theory of biological macroevolution. And here's the quote. At times, some students may insist that certain conclusions of science cannot be true because of certain religious or philosophical beliefs they hold. It is appropriate for the teacher to express, in this regard, I understand that you may have personal reservations about accepting this scientific evidence, but it is scientific knowledge about which there is no reasonable doubt among scientists in their field, and it is my responsibility to teach it because it is part of our common intellectual heritage. So what I do is I fix on
The words used to describe scientific claims, conclusions, evidence, knowledge, no reasonable doubt, intellectual heritage, and then the words that are used to describe philosophical or religious claims are personal reservations and beliefs.
I see.
Now, I know what stands behind that, and I can give an illustration of scientism at work here, but what this actually means is that the claims of science have authority to guide us in our pursuit of education and knowledge, but the claims of religion and philosophy are private and personal. Now, that's scientism. That presupposes and is rooted in a view of scientific knowledge as being either vastly superior or perhaps the only way of knowing relative to, say, philosophical or religious claims.
Okay, so we understand that you're saying that it's the message behind the statement there is essentially science is the authority and religious and philosophical concerns take a back seat to science when it comes to these kinds of things.
Yes.
Yeah. So okay. So Stephen,
well, that's your reading. I mean, if you actually look what it says, it just says, look, this is the scientific consensus. This is what scientists believe. And it's perfectly reasonable for teachers to be able to say that in the classroom. And it in no way does that suggest or commit this person to saying that there aren't other ways of knowing about things or that people don't make mistakes and so on. This is not a commitment to scientism. It's being read as that because, presumably because JP doesn't like it very much. So he's reading the science into it. And he does this not just in this occasion, but on another in the two other examples also. So, for example, he has Michael Kinsley says something about embryo cells. He says there's nothing human about them, which is highly contentious, of course. And he also adds, and except if you choose to believe it, a soul. Maybe there's a soul, he says, if you choose to believe
it. And the language he uses is except if you choose to believe it.
Now, why would he say that? Because he doesn't believe in souls personally. If you don't believe in the soul, you can't say, well, you could know that somebody has a human soul because you can't know what isn't true. So clearly this person is skeptical about the existence of souls. That's not scientism. And to say, to jump to the conclusion that the reason he says you can't know people have souls, right, to jump to the conclusion that he says that because of scientism is clearly a highly uncharitable reading when the much more obvious explanation is he simply doesn't believe in them.
Okay, let me just give the full quote for context here and then have you respond, JP. So this is, this is in a section that you title Scientism Illustrated, and you give this example. On June 25th, 2001, Time magazine featured an article by journalist Michael Kinsley defending stem cell research on human embryos. He wrote, "These embryos are microscopic groupings of a few differentiated cells. There is nothing human about them except potential and, if you choose to believe it, a soul." So again, give us your view, JP, on why that does count as an example of scientism being illustrated in the public sphere.
Well, there are two claims that are being considered in his statement. One of them is a biological claim that he takes there to be an established fact. It's something that we know, and there's just no controversy about it. The other one is, as Stephen has pointed out, it's the claim that if you choose to believe it, there's a soul. Now, the point here is not that he doesn't believe in a soul, and thus he's going to say, well, if you believe in that sort of thing. The issue is why he doesn't believe in a soul. And I think it's because in the passage itself, souls are the sorts of things that you have to simply choose to believe or not believe. And what that means is that there's not a proof in one way or the other. And so the reason he doesn't believe in it is because there's no evidence for souls, and so he's chosen not to. So I take this to be an example of where he's relegating a sort of a metaphysical or even a theological claim to the realm of choosing to believe. That's the cognitive status of claims like that.
As I understand it, JP, you're taking examples from popular culture and saying here's where the underlying assumptions are essentially scientism. You feel that JP's being a little bit creative in his
quite creative. If I was writing a book about scientism and I wanted to show that it was all pervasive and the intellectual and cultural air we breathe, then surely I wouldn't have any problem whatsoever finding several clear-cut examples of scientism being espoused. But instead we get three examples, all of which don't even look to me like scientism. I can see how you might want to put a scientistic gloss on them, but there's no clear commitment to scientism in them. And that should make a red light come on, surely, at this point. If the author of the book can't even come up with clear, concrete, irrefutable examples of scientism, that may suggest that it's being exaggerated, bit like communism used to be.
Let me let you respond, JP. Why do you feel you're not exaggerating the way in which scientism, in your view, is very widespread and so on?
Well, I make the point in the book that scientism is in the drinking water. That means that it's pervasive throughout culture. I've lectured on 200 college campuses, and I have been around, and I have confronted people who hold to scientism all the time. It also fills the literature on philosophy of mind and philosophical naturalism, debates about naturalism. So the literature is filled with scientism. But
why didn't you actually use an example?
Let me just finish this, and I'll give it back. So I am picking examples where the scientism is not clearly stated but implicit. And it's obvious that it's in the drinking water because that is what is being assumed by the statements being made. And so I'm trying to illustrate how pervasive scientism is. Even though people don't know what it is and don't know how to articulate it, it is what is underlying their view of various subjects. And so I think that I'm not adding a gloss to these. I am actually surfacing what is being presupposed by the explicit claims being made in these examples.
If I could maybe just to move us along a bit in the conversation here, I admittedly you don't very often find people who state it as explicitly as a Peter Atkins, let's say, Stephen. But I've had other shows with Lawrence Krauss. He's said very similar things about the why questions are pointless questions. They're silly questions. The only questions worth asking there's plenty of that around, I think. And I do run into plenty of people, I think, who basically believe in maybe the weak scientism that JP's outlined, that ultimately all questions do ultimately have a kind of naturalistic kind of hard science result. So whether it's history, psychology, whatever, it's all going to ultimately come down to the movements of molecules is sort of what it will ultimately be explained by, even if there are kind of phenomena that sort of sit above that, that are, you know, emergent, as a Daniel Dennett might put it.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to deny. I mean, just as, you know, there certainly were communists around, right, in the United States when everyone saw communism everywhere. There certainly were some communists, but it was hugely exaggerated, okay, and inflated. So similarly, there are people that are guilty of scientism or something close to it now, and there is sometimes a sort of a too much respect, slightly too much respect given to science, and, you know, there are exaggerations made, sure, and so on. So I don't want to deny that, but what does concern me is the way in which arguments and claims may be shut down by the use of this term, scientism. The finger comes out and it's pointed at you. You're guilty of scientism. So now I don't really have to take your views seriously anymore. This is the most common way in which the term is used in the culture now. So, for example, you know, public enemy number one, Richard Dawkins, right? The minute he opens his mouth, you can be sure somebody's going to point a finger at him and say, you, Richard Dawkins, should remember that there are more things in heaven and hell than I've dreamt of in your philosophy. Show a little modesty and humility. Acknowledge that, you know, there are other ways of knowing, blah, 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 blah. But the truth is that actually, if you look at what he's saying, it doesn't rely on scientism at all, insofar as in The God Delusion, for example, he presents what he thinks is, I mean, I'm not so sure, but what he thinks is a scientific argument to show that there's probably no God.
Right.
Right. For example, that is not actually scientism. And in fact, this is what I would be particularly keen to discuss now with JP. I mean, do you, JP, think that science is capable of showing perhaps that there probably is a God, or that there probably isn't a God? What do you think?
Yes. I think scientific claims of certain kinds can lend support to theism. The Big Bang and the Second Law, I think, have been helpful in establishing that there was a beginning to the universe. I think the philosophical arguments for a beginning are even more powerful than the scientific ones. I think that I think 95% of science is completely irrelevant to Christianity or God or what. I don't care, mm-hmm, if a methane molecule has 4 hydrogens or 15.
Yeah.
As a Christian thinker, I think the other 5%, there's been about 3% that's been in favor of the existence of God. And I would say 2% have counted against largely the early chapters of Genesis. I don't think there are many scientific claims that can be used to count against God's existence, but I don't say that in principle that there couldn't be something
So it would be a mistake then to accuse Richard Dawkins of scientism if he thinks that in principle science might be able to come up with grounds for thinking that there's probably no God. It would be a mistake to accuse Richard Dawkins of scientism for supposing that.
Absolutely, it would be a mistake.
That's now, some concession. Because we've had lots of other people, surely, on this show, like Galister McGrath and so on, pointing a finger at Richard Dawkins and saying, you are guilty of scientism, Richard. But you, JP, are saying, no, he's not, insofar as he's committed.
No, I did not say that. I said that if from the fact that he's making the claim that there are certain scientific evidence that makes the existence of God improbable, that itself is not an example of scientism.
Yeah, good.
Now, that doesn't mean he doesn't hold the scientism. That would have to be settled by things that he has said elsewhere,
yeah,
or kind of his general dismissive attitude toward.
But this is important. Let's just get completely clear about this then. So anyone who accuses Richard Dawkins of scientism purely on the grounds that he thinks that science might in principle come up with grounds for thinking that there's probably no God, anyone that makes that accusation is making a mistake, and he's not guilty on that basis.
That's right.
Good.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that was in a point of agreement. I suppose the thing that I think we probably need to get towards before the show runs out of time is kind of where this all takes us, because there's been measures of agreement between you both. You both agree that a hard scientism is certainly wrong. I think then Stephen says, but I do appreciate the empirical method, and perhaps you give that more weight than JP does, who feels that there's a lot that we can know in a kind of direct, intuitive way that isn't necessarily open to it, the empirical method and so on.
The reason I introduced empiricism is because it often gets muddled up with scientism.
Right.
And in fact, empiricism's got a bit more going for it, you know. Okay. And I can see why, if you're Peter Atkins, for example, and you're wedded to empiricism, that would then lead you to think that philosophy must be a waste of time, because how could you find out anything about the world outside your own mind by sitting in your armchair and having a good old think about it? And I have some sympathy with that view. It's just that I think that philosophy can reveal important truths and provide important insights, despite the fact that it doesn't
right.
do that.
Yeah. But I think where you're going to disagree, and perhaps this is where we'll go just in our final section next, is on the implications of the parts of those aspects of knowledge that don't necessarily come to us through science. And so I would like to talk about whether logic, math, reason, and even other things you cover in some depth in the book, JP, like the experience of consciousness and other things, not that we'll have a lot of time to go into them, do actually point to something other than a naturalistic kind of explanation for them. That's obviously where you land up in the book. So we're going to go to another quick break, and we'll come back with my guests today, two philosophers, one a Christian, one an atheist, JP Moreland and Stephen Law. We're debating, is scientism the new religion?
Believers and non-believers will all be helped, says Tim Keller, a wonderfully clear and accessible case for Christianity from a man who has hosted many of the world's most prominent skeptics and atheists, says Andrew Wilson. Beautifully written, brilliantly argued, will thrill and challenge, says R.T. Kendall. Unbelievable, the book by Justin Brierley. Download a free chapter and find out how it can help you make the case for Christ. Unbelievablebook.co.uk.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable, and we'll continue the conversation between JP Moreland and Stephen Law very shortly. A reminder, though, that JP Moreland, one of our fantastic speakers at this year's Unbelievable Conference, Saturday the 20th of July in central London. It's at Westminster Central Hall, a great venue. We were there back in 2014, and we're back for 2019 now. We're inviting you to join the revolution and speak truth in a post-truth world. That's our conference theme this year, in partnership with Biola Apologetics and ADF International, a day to equip you to share the truth of Christianity in a world of fake news, all about better conversations, responding to different worldviews, being a confident Christian in the world today. As I say, JP Moreland and Craig Hazen from Biola, loads of other speakers as well, Paul Coleman and Andy Tonhauser of ADF International. We've got Krish Kandiah there, Sarah Lumger there, Bruxy Cavey's coming over from Canada. We've got Ruth Jackson and Emily Howarth, and more to be announced. I've got some exciting people to be confirmed very shortly, but it's all there on the website if you want to check it out so far, the lineup, the theme, and book for cheap early bird ticket prices now. That's the thing to do, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievableconference. Student and group discounts also available there. Book now and join the revolution, and you'll be hearing more about it in the course of the coming months as well, of course, as we feature some of the speakers and topics that we'll be discussing at the conference. But all of you early birders, get in there now. I know a lot of you have been waiting, standing by for us to release the ticketing, and now's your opportunity from the Unbelievable webpage, or equally at the site there, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievableconference. I'll be looking through some of your feedback to the show a little bit later on in the programme. But straight after Unbelievable, here on Premier Christian Radio, on the profile, it's Tim Jupp, former Delirious band member, and now the main man behind one of the UK's biggest Christian music festivals, the Big Church Day Out. He'll be talking to Sam Hales about his faith and life, also available on its own profile podcast. Next week here on Unbelievable, the Cessationist and the Charismatic. They'll be debating tongues, prophecy, and the gifts of the Spirit. Are they for today? As I'm joined by Andrew Wilson and Simon Arscott. Andrew is our charismatic in that debate, and he's got a new book out on that subject, Spirit and Sacrament. It's called An Invitation to Eucharismatic Worship. So look forward to that at the same time next week. Right now, let's get back into the final part of today's conversation.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the show. So excited to have been joined on the show today by J.P. Moreland and Stephen Law, both philosophers. One's a Christian, one's an atheist. J.P.'s new book, Scientism and Secularism, is out now, published by Crosswell. I'll make sure there are links to that from today's edition of the show. Plus, of course, Stephen Law has plenty of books to his name. And I'll make sure there are links from today's programme to his website as well, where you can find out more about them. We've been asking, is scientism the new religion, on the basis of this book by you, JP? We've obviously done some debate about defining scientism and all the examples you cite of scientism valid and so on. Ultimately, though, it strikes me that you as much have naturalism in your sights as scientism in this book, because essentially, as you've said, they kind of go hand in hand very often. People who do appear to have scientistic type beliefs are often making the assumption that all that exists in the universe is matter and energy and, you know, the laws of nature. And for you, lots of the things that we have to make assumptions about and have direct experience of, like consciousness, laws of logic, maths, moral knowledge and so on, themselves seem to point away from naturalism and towards theism, towards a supernatural source. So do you want to speak to that, albeit briefly now, and we'll see what Stephen has to say in response?
Well, there is a bevy of arguments that I believe are successful in making it more reasonable to believe in a personal God than to be agnostic about that or not to believe it. And these arguments, some of them appropriate empirical data from science, like the discovery of fine-tuning and so on, but some of them don't involve that. For an example would be the origin of consciousness. There just is no strict naturalist explanation of the origin of consciousness. And by a strict naturalist, I mean someone who would be a physicalist without there being such things as emergent properties. So I claim that consciousness, if you say in the beginning were the particles, and the history of the universe is the history of the rearrangement of those into more and more structurally complex geometrical arrangements, and that at some point, presto, a conscious state appears, that's like getting something from nothing. If matter is the way, as David Papineau points out in his book Philosophical Naturalism, if it's the way that physics and chemistry tell us it is, with reasonable projections toward the future, one thing we know is that the future physics and chemistry is not going to contain mental categories. And so thought, belief, sensation, and so on just isn't going to be a part of that framework. And so if you have in the beginning was the logos, then your fundamental entity is conscious, and you don't have any difficulty with there being subsequent beings who exemplify mental properties. This has been, David Chalmers has acknowledged that this is true. And so what he has done is moved to panpsychism. He calls it proto-panpsychism, and it's a certain specific version of it. But I don't think that you can explain the origin of macro consciousness from micro panpsychism of any version for two reasons, and then I'll quit. Mm. The first one is that it's clear that conscious states and physical states are contingently connected. There are all kinds of thought experiments that are clearly conceivable. And in this case, I think their being conceivable is a good guide to their possibility. And that would be a situation where the same brain state could be correlated with an appearance of red or an appearance of blue. There's no necessary connection here. The second problem is that if all the fundamental entities at the microphysical level have an attenuated form of consciousness, and they come together to give rise to, say, my consciousness, you have the combination problem. It's hard to know how you could get unified consciousness like I possess simply by the concatenation of billions of little particles or other entities that have attenuated consciousness. And Chalmers says that the combination problem, the problem of getting a unity of consciousness from little bits of consciousness, has never been solved. And it won't be solved. And I think that the existence of consciousness through a Bayesian approach or through just an inference to the best explanation is best explained by the existence of a conscious theistic God, rather than starting with matter and trying to figure out how you get consciousness.
Okay, so that was a super brief explanation of a very big topic, obviously, which you've written about at much greater length elsewhere, JP. Yeah. And at the risk of this turning into a debate that's far too short on consciousness, I suppose the point is that for someone like JP, Stephen, consciousness is not the kind of phenomenon that lends itself to simply science answers simply from science, looking at what happens to molecules in motion and that kind of thing. And to go further than that, he doesn't think it coheres well with an atheist or naturalist view of reality. He says that it seems to fit much better with the view that there is a consciousness out there. There's a transcendent type of consciousness within which this consciousness sort of finds itself. So, yeah.
Hmm.
Where do you want to go?
Golly, what a massive can of worms that one is. Well, you know, like I said right at the beginning of this program, I'm not wedded to naturalism. I mean, you know, I lean a little bit in that direction, but if it turns out that there are more facts than the natural facts, it's not.
Is there any label you are willing to wear, or are you agnostic on all of these fronts?
No, I'm quite happy with atheist. I'm definitely an atheist. I'm not particularly wedded to naturalism. There are famously problems for empiricism when it comes to maths and morals and minds and modals, as they're known. Mm-hmm. You know, necessary truth. What's the nature of that? Is it embedded in the world or merely a product of our conceptual scheme, say? So there are problems for how we could get to know about this kind of moral or modal reality if it's out there mind independently. Empiricists say so it's not out there mind independently because otherwise we wouldn't be able to get to know about it. And then naturalism also struggles traditionally with these kinds of facts. How do you accommodate them within a purely naturalistic framework? And some people think it can be done and some people think it can't be done. What theists do is they hijack this whole traditional philosophical debate, right, and say, oh, look, there's loads of things you can't explain or you're not sure about there. We've got that covered. God did it. It's the good old God of the gaps.
Well, now you are sounding like Peter Atkins, who basically said the same thing.
Yeah, it's like this, you know, we're sitting in my front room and I think to myself, hang on, my keys, I put them on the sofa and now they're on the mantelpiece. And why is the tap, has this tap started to drip? I don't know the explanation for that. And you say, Stephen, I've got it covered. There's a conscious being in your room. It's a gremlin. And it moved your keys. It has the power to move them around. It desires that kind of thing. It desires to confuse us. And it likes to cause mischief and start taps. By invoking a hidden super being with magical powers, you can explain anything immediately, which is why humans have always done it. When we couldn't explain why the planets moved, they were gods. When we couldn't explain why the plants grew, there were nature spirits and so on. It is the traditional default explanation to offer, and it will immediately explain whatever you need. But is it the best explanation, gremlins?
Right, okay.
Really? I rather doubt it. Worse still, okay, we've got really good evidence against gremlins, and we've got really good evidence against the existence of the Judeo-Christian God.
I was going to say, when we covered this in that debate, as I say, several years ago now with William Lane Craig, you did say, yeah, I think on balance, I do believe in objective moral values, but if that means God exists, then I will rather reject my belief in objective moral values than concede God. You said something along these lines.
Yeah, that's because a
weird
gloss.
Think the evidence for God is not there, or there's evidence against God.
JP has been happy to acknowledge that you could have, you know, Richard Dawkins could potentially cook up a science or observation based argument that would show that there's probably no God. Now, actually, you don't need science, you just need empirical observation. There is abundant evidence that actually, if there is any kind of consciousness behind the universe, it's not supremely powerful and all good and loving and benevolent. Just look at childhood mortality rates over the 200,000-year history of human beings. Most children never made it past the age of five. They suffered horribly, their parents suffered horribly. You know, and that's just one example. The world is filled with horror and pain, which is very good evidence, I'm going to suggest, against the existence of God, even if we could show that there was some kind of consciousness behind
it. Well, everything. Now we are opening another huge can of worms. But let's come back to you, JP, because, I mean, just to go back to Stephen's original point, essentially he's saying, OK, there are mysteries and naturalism doesn't seem to fit very well with all of them, granted, but invoking God is basically God of the gaps, doing what they used to do when they wanted an explanation for the rain or the movements of the planets. So why for you are these particular examples you bring in the book not that kind of God of the gap kind of philosophy?
Well, two things. I mean, first of all, I think it is, with all due respect, I think it's absurd to paint a brush of God of the gaps over the history of natural theology. That is one of the richest intellectual histories of any subject that's ever been investigated. And the arguments for God's existence are not examples of God of the gap arguments. They're attempts to explain certain facts that a theistic being makes removes our puzzlement about them and satisfies various criteria of a good explanation. So that's number one. I think that most of these arguments, including the argument from consciousness, is not a God of the gaps argument. It's a different sort of argument. The second thing I would say would be that I think maybe Stephen could comment on this, but I think he's using his view that cognitive science has kind of demonstrated that we're inclined to project agency onto the world and see these see beings everywhere, that this is nothing but just projection. And I just want to say a couple of things about that. I mean, number one, the biblical God is not the sort of God anybody would want to project. Project a Trinity, project some being that is completely sovereign and omniscient and makes demands on us. The biblical God is not anywhere near the collective subconscious or behavior of Israel or the apostles. I think the second thing I would say would be that there is a clear class of experiences that survive this projection thesis. These would be religious experiences like specific answers to prayer, a divine healing, a group of people seeing the same angels at the same time and describing them identically, of which there is, in the first two cases, empirically verifiable evidence that God answered this prayer. So, for example, there was a Jewish woman that came to our prayer room years ago, and she had 31 points of cancer in her life and was in hospice. And she was prayed over for two nights. And the third night she was prayed over, she felt something move in her body. And she went to her doctor, and the cancer was completely gone. Nothing was there. There have also been blind people that have been healed. There are people who have had growth in healing in cracks in their bones instantaneously that is medically documented. And so there are all kinds of, not to mention the resurrection and the biblical miracles for which there's historical evidence. So I think that the, in summary, that this projection thesis, even if it covers certain religious experiences, and that would explain, by the way, why there's diversity. So many people just project their culture. Christianity doesn't. But there is a class of religious experiences that do not fall under that category because they have empirically testable implications and would be satisfy the requirements of testimony in a court of law.
We are going to have to start drawing things to a close here, and there's so many more directions we could go in from here. I'm sure 100 things in that you want to respond to, Stephen. Yeah. What if I could ask you, though, to start to draw things to a close? What any final thoughts as we begin to sum up today's show? Start with you, Stephen.
Oh dear, I wasn't expecting to answer that question.
Well, you answer the question you want to answer at this point, then, and I'll draw things to a close instead.
Well, I would. Well, let me just briefly respond to what JP just said. I find the suggestion was that people wouldn't want to believe in God. Really? I mean, every now and then I get an email coming to my mailbox that says, if you pass this message on, you'll receive good luck. And if you don't, you're going to have very bad luck. And of course, this is very effective. A lot of people will pass it on. It's how those messages get spread around the internet very, very quickly. Now, that's a pretty potent carrot and stick combination. Eternal life or hell, eternal damnation, there is no conceivably greater carrot and stick combination. That is...
Stephen, to correct you, I did not say that people don't want to believe in God. That's not my claim. My claim was that nobody would come up with the biblical God if they were projecting. They would come up with a much tamer God that allowed them to do various things.
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, if you actually look at various different religions and the very strange claims that they come up with, it's always quite baffling to me why they decided, why people decided, you know, why the Mormons decided that everyone gets their own planet, why the Scientologists believe the ludicrous things that they do about us having been descended from aliens that came here thousands of years ago in spaceships shaped like DC-10s. Why on earth would they come up with that? It's not in their interest. It's laughable.
I agree.
So you know, the fact is that cults and religions do just come up with claims which are not particularly necessarily attractive to the people that want to believe them at the time. I all sorts of reasons for that. I think that you also mentioned miracles and the woman being cured. Now, look, I'm not in any position to comment on that, but I can comment on one case that I know of, which is a friend of mine, certainly a good acquaintance of mine that I won't name and I won't embarrass him. But a long time ago now, he told me that what got him into Christianity was a miracle, that he used to have one leg a little bit longer than the other one, and that he saw the other leg grow due to the power of Jesus or whatever it was, so that they became the same length, and he never had the kind of back problems that he used to have after that. Now, this, I know, is an old musical trick, and if you go on the internet, you can see it being done, right? He was duped. It wasn't a real miracle. It's a remarkably common, in scare quotes, miracle that Christians do to bring people on board and get them in line with the faith. And I didn't know what to say to him because I knew the truth and I knew he'd been duped, but I couldn't tell him. I couldn't bring myself
to tell
him.
It's funny, though, because if I might butt in here with my view on this, I think there are definitely people who are charlatans on this front. But I have actually met people who said, I had a leg that was shorter than the other, I got prayed, and they went to a doctor, had it measured, and they had the before and the after, and in fact, the leg was the same. Now, they didn't show me the medical records, I'm just going on what they told me, and they said, and my back problems cleared up, etc., etc.
The one leg shorter than the other.
All right,
it's laughable.
That wasn't the example JP gave, of course.
But maybe there are some legitimate cases, maybe there's some real miracles, but I don't buy it.
Okay, all right. JP, I'm going to. We do need to wrap this up, so I'm going to give the last word to you and take us out to the end of today's show.
Well, thank you, Stephen, for a lively discussion, and Justin for having me on. And I look forward to being at the conference coming up this summer. I would just say that my book, Scientism and Secularism, is an attempt to say that a widespread view that science is the only way or the vastly superior way of knowing reality is irrational. And that there are other ways of knowing, and there are a number of facts that theism can explain, and that naturalism or atheism has a very, very difficult time explaining, but theism can explain. So that's what I'm trying to make a case for in my book, and that's what we've tried to discuss here today.
We have, and we've gone into some very interesting territory. Lots of cans of worms open that we can't do justice to, like consciousness and why is there evil and miracles. By the way, if you're interested in the miracle question, very interesting conference coming up soon that I will be hosting out in Squim in Washington on looking at miracle claims with Christians and atheists present. That should be an interesting one. I'm sure you'll be interested to hear that one, Stephen. We've got a skeptic coming for that debate. Michael Shermer will be involved, who I'm sure you're familiar with, Stephen.
Yes.
Opposite Luke Vanderway, who is going to be making the case for miracles. So
perhaps you can get him to do one while he's.
Well, who knows? Who knows what might happen? Anyway, that's a side note. For now, I'm very much looking forward to having you here in the UK, JP, for Unbelievable the Conference 2019, Saturday 20th July. Thank you very much for being on the show. All the best with the book. Stephen, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
And crossing swords with JP.
Yes,
today.
Yeah, no, it was fun. And I enjoyed the book. It's certainly a very well-written book, even if I don't agree with it.
Thank you, Stephen.
Sure.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Let me know what you thought by email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find more details about my guests and also comment underneath today's show as well at the website too. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Thanks to those who've been tweeting me as well in the last week with responses to some of the recent shows. Let's go to one or two of these. This was a lovely one, actually, from Sam on Twitter, who says he's in Halifax in his local cafe shop reading the Unbelievable book. Why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. You say loving and devouring it, 26% in one sitting. Thanks, Justin. Very accessible and helpful for people like me. Keep going. And I assume by the fact you say you're 26% of the way in, you're reading on a Kindle there, Sam. But thank you very much. Available, of course, in signed physical copies as well from our website. That's unbelievablebook.co.uk. But a lot of people still tweeting on that show that caused so much interest a few weeks ago, which, of course, relates to the topic we were debating today. That was John Lennox and Peter Atkins on whether science can explain everything. This one by Rick Barker said, just listen to the show. Ding ding is right. I felt Professor John Lennox was far more rational and grown up than Mr. Atkins, saying a Nobel Peace Prize winner needs to grow up due to his Christianity. Now that's childish. Mr. Lennox did his usual outstanding job. Thanks for airing it. This one from Jim said, just listened. John was very gracious and often commended Peter on his intellect, though sadly Peter often displayed such an arrogant and sarcastic attitude, it didn't serve his discussion well. And Elahi said, fantastic conversation, all due respect to Peter Atkins' brilliance. Even if I were an objective observer, which I admit I'm not, I'd be so inspired by the gentle humility of John Lennox in the face of arrogant opposition, I would want the spirit he has. If you want to tweet your thoughts about today's show, feel free to do that at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page, where you can see what I post on a regular basis from the show and other places too. And of course, leave your comments there as well. Still on that Atkins versus Lennox debate, Kwan got in touch to say on email, writing in from Singapore, been listening to that debate. It's been quite fascinating. Great job moderating two heavyweights. As for the debate, I find Atkins fundamentally contradicts himself. He stands firmly that the God answer is a lazy get-out clause. However, he also uses this same lazy method to push away philosophical questions that point to the purpose of the universe by lazily labelling them as nonsense questions. It's quite clear why he does this, considering his stand that he'd never change his belief, regardless of the evidence shown to him. And towards the end of the debate, I was quite pleasantly surprised. The one thing I never understood about the atheist point of view is how they could redefine the idea of nothing as proposed by Lawrence Krauss. And the fact that even an atheist like Peter Atkins doesn't believe in that redefinition goes to show how ridiculous a cop-out that explanation seems. You also want to say Josh McDowell is coming to your church to give a sermon in March. I wouldn't have known about him if not for your programme, so I want to give give a shout out for any more Singaporean listeners to come to Orchard Road Presbyterian Church on the 10th of March, 9 a.m. There you go. If you're listening in Singapore, that's obviously the place to be. Going back a bit further to the debate on consciousness, something we obviously touched on today's show as well, but which we did in some depth, a deep dive, as it were, between Raymond Tallis and David Bentley Hart a few weeks ago. Mark Vernon on Twitter actually got in touch. And Mark's someone who's looked into this a great deal as well. I think in the space of a tweet, you very helpfully summed up some of the issues between them. Is there difference this, you say? Raymond Tallis looks inside and sees one that-a thing inexplicably after another. David Bentley Hart looks inside and one sees one thing after another and steady, pure consciousness in whom the thoughts live, move, etc. And the mystery is why one doesn't see what's self-evident to the other. Others wanted to weigh in on that debate, which did get fairly deep and philosophical, and sometimes some have said impenetrable as well, at least from David Bentley Hart's perspective that he was bringing. But Robert says, a great show with David Bentley Hart and Raymond Tallis on the mystery of consciousness. I must admit a certain level of embarrassment that I found a great deal of the discussion going well over my head, and I have a PhD in systematic theology. I can at least use the excuse that my area isn't philosophical theology. And I take heart that it seems that Tallis also had a hard time grasping what Hart was saying. I do appreciate Hart on a number of other fronts, however, such as his book Atheist Delusions and his poignant book on God and suffering in The Doors of the Sea, Where Was God in the Tsunami? But I must take issue with his one slip in Christian charity when N.T. Wright was brought up. It is one thing to jokingly say who when you raise his name, but then to proceed to insult him by questioning whether the man was even a gentleman was a low blow, not appropriate from a believing Christian, and poorly placed as it was irrelevant to the discussion. Churlish and uncalled for. Shame on him. I took that as being a not a very serious comment when he said that. If he is a gentleman, I took that as being tongue-in-cheek from David Bentley Hart. But I could see how it could get misconstrued. Anyway, glad you enjoyed the discussion, Robert. And Peter, on that debate on consciousness, says, a really interesting show. You continue to thrill and challenge with your choice of topics and guests. Looking forward to the rest of the 2019 lineup. One small criticism, though. I don't think we ever got to the overall nuts and bolts of Raymond Tallis' argument. He stated his premise very briefly at the beginning, but then it seemed like the show turned into more of a David Bentley Hart Q&A session. I felt bad for Dr. Tallis. He didn't get more time to talk about his book, which, just as a reminder, is called Logos and is about how we make sense of the world. I understand that that's the way these shows go sometimes, but I've thought in the past that if you're having a guest on to discuss a book or idea, you should be given at least 5 uninterrupted minutes to clearly lay out their premise and supporting argumentation before letting the conversation partner in. Anyway, I hope to encourage you to just simply improve upon the great work already happening. Thank you very much, Peter. Always taken in that spirit. Thank you very much. Your comments always welcome, whatever the show may be. I'm sure we will probably do another edition with Raymond Tallis and allow him a little more space to expand on his view as an atheist of how he comes to terms with consciousness. Very different, obviously, to the way other atheists do, like Daniel Dennett and so on. But maybe that's one JP Moreland could engage in as a subject we started on but never really did justice to on today's show. For the moment, thank you very much for being with me on today's edition of the show. Do make sure to check out all the other great things you can find from Unbelievable. Resources, videos, apps, newsletters and such. You can find links to all of them from the Unbelievable page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But the real thing I want you to do, especially if you're based in the UK, is make sure you get yourself booked in for Unbelievable the Conference 2019. Very excited. We're returning to Central Hall, London, and we're going to be doing it in the company of some brilliant speakers, including JP Moreland, who we heard from today. All the details available from our website. Go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievableconference and let me tell you what's coming next week.
You're unbelievable.
It's the charismatic and the cessationist debating whether tongues, prophecy and other charismatic spiritual gifts are for today. Our charismatic will be Andrew Wilson, our cessationist Simon Arscott. They're going to have a great conversation. Hope you can join me for it same time next week. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.